Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. It's nice having you come back today. We are in Acts chapter 24. We're basically got Paul arriving in Caesarea after with it being escorted with the military coming from Fort Antonia under the commander or tribune Lysias' direction. And he's going to appear before Felix, which I should have wrote his name up here. He's the governor that he's going to be appearing before. And these are some players that are involved in it. You're going to have the high priest right away indicating how important this trial is to the Jews. Remember, a group has asked to have Paul transferred from Fort Antonia about a quarter of a mile down to where the Sanhedrin meet in the Hall of the Hewn Stone, which is right off the western wall, apparently, according to Josephus, and maybe some excavation that has taken place there. And on his way, they're going to try to assassinate him this time and kill him, these 40 guys. They've taken a vow. Ananias, the high priest, will be there. The Sanhedrin will be there. At least they're calling for it. But we saw last week that Paul's nephew, again, who is this? How's this all play out? It'd be Paul's sister's son is in Jerusalem at the time, somehow lives there maybe. Maybe he's been going to school there. Again, these are just things we don't know. It's just interesting to find out he's got relatives there. And comes and tells Paul, we found this out. Paul sends him to the commander, the tribune, Lysias, who then says, let's get him out of town right away. Lysias' goal is to keep peace, Roman peace. He's got Paul under protection. Paul is in prison, but he's more or less under Roman protection until he can go to trial, because they know their people are trying to kill him, from the riot on the Temple Mount, from just the mob of people, to the Sanhedrin. But now these 40 guys that want to assassinate him. Even when Paul left Corinth, there's an assassination attempt for him. So Paul's life is in danger. And who's stepping up here is the commander, and is going to take him over to Caesarea to the governor's place. And I've got some maps on there. These are just things I just took right off the internet. We've looked at pictures of these earlier. If you look right there on the this is Caesarea by the sea. You can refer to, you know, other maps maybe in your Bible or maps that I've handed out to know where Caesarea is at in location to Jerusalem. But it's on the Mediterranean coast. And one of the things to notice is that part. Let's go to the bottom picture. Go to the bottom picture on page one. And what is amazing is that we talked about the man-made port that Herod the Great made. And you can see going all the way around there where letter E, letter D is. E is kind of the entrance to the port, and then that was made with some kind of Roman concrete blocks built up underneath, and then you could walk all the way around it in some kind of a portico that they had, or colonnade that they had, and the ships could come in through port by E there, and then dock along there, and that's where they could bring their supplies in, their shipping, their guests. And Paul landed there on a couple of occasions, would land in that port. Then right there, letter H, we saw pictures of that earlier. That's the Hippodrome. Then further over, there's that little part sticking out where it's letter B on the bottom picture. That is Herod the Great's palace, one of the many palaces of Herod the Great that he built out there in the sea. In the center is, again, some kind of a swimming pool, some kind of fresh water that was pumped in. There's an aqueduct that you can see coming in there. I believe that's, letter F on that going up, and you can still see the remains of it there on the beach. And what's interesting now then, of course, there's several things we could talk about. But where I've got it circled there, that is, Paul is being held, it says, in Herod's palace. So he's out there somewhere in Herod's palace in some kind of, confinement. But when he comes to trial, that part that is circled, that's like the government buildings. That's where he's going to be on trial at. The picture right above that is from a different angle, but you can figure that out. Kind of, you can see that's Herod's palace out there in the Mediterranean Sea. And I showed you pictures of it, you can still walk out there. You can still see mosaics out there. The building is gone, but you can still see floor mosaics out there on the stone of what used to be some kind of, floor banquet hall, whatever, in Herod's palace. But then, where I've got that drawn, that's the location of the government buildings where he's going to stand before Felix, and then Festus, and eventually Herod Agrippa II, Bernice. And then the picture right above it is an actual satellite picture from today. Again, these are not my pictures. You can see some of them have got references on them. I just Googled it. And sometimes my pictures, when I Google it, my pictures pop up, but I've already got those. But these popped up right here. And these are I have not been you know, I don't have this kind of drawing ability or something, so I just stole them. I hope people steal my stuff. Sometimes people ask, if it's really nice to ask if they can use it. Of course, I say yes, but it's like I don't always ask. I just take it and print it. I know it's probably not right, but so I, you know, forgive me if it's wrong. But there it is. You can Google it too. That's the beauty of the internet, I guess, or the corruption of the internet, whatever. But then you see the remains of it. It's amazing. What was it? It's like in the, oh, they started excavating it like in the 60s or 70s or something, the first one. And then the guy who found Herod the Great's tomb actually did some more work in the 90s out there, I think. But anyway, there's, you can see it right there and what's remained. And you can stand right where Paul's, the building was. You can still see the floor. And we've got pictures of Tony standing there. So anyway, what we're about to read, this is where it takes place, in Caesarea by the sea. It's a real place. These are real people. There's no doubt about it that this is a real place. There's no doubt about it that these people existed. They're recorded in history in other places. This lawyer's name, he does not pop up anywhere else, but we know he existed because Josephus records his attitude and what the people thought about him. Even the Talmud records a little jingle, a little poem insulting Ananias because of his greed. Felix, of course, is recorded. So we know these people existed. So here we go. We are in chapter 24. I'm going to read through this. On page 2, I've got a few points I hope to make as we go through this. Before we start, I will do this. On page 2 at the bottom, Paul's going to refer to 12 days, that it's been 12 days. And it appears that Paul's going to spend about 12 days, maybe 11 days, in Jerusalem, plus a day traveling to Caesarea. And this is how it's going to be broken down. Day 1, Paul arrives in Jerusalem, and he got the reference there, 21:18. Day 2, he meets with the church leaders, you know, mentions that the next day. And we've referred to this as we've gone by. I think I got this reference out of the book, I'm one day off. When they say day 10, I'm saying day 9, the way I counted it. So I'd have to go back and compare it. But Paul's going to end up saying 12 days. But those 12 days do not include the days of travel from Jerusalem to the stopping point, the city that was named after Herod the Great's father, Antipatris or whatever. I showed you that last week. I don't have it on the top of my head. And then to Caesarea. But anyway, those are the days that Paul spent. So this whole thing that we've been talking about it longer than it actually took place, 12 days that Paul's in Jerusalem. The longest period is day 3 to 9. That's when Paul's under the 7-day purification where he goes and washes on the day 3 or day 4, and then washes on day 7. And then he goes to the Temple Mount. That's why when he got caught, goes to the Temple Mount to pay for the offerings of the animals, the liquids that are going to be poured out for the guys that are getting, and the haircuts of the guys that have taken the Nazarite vow. Paul himself is going through a cleansing, purification rite. These guys are finishing a Nazarite vow. And that's what they're doing on the Temple Mount when he gets arrested, and we know all that. Okay, so with that being said, let's go ahead and take a look at what's taking place here. Chapter 24, verse 1. 5 days later, that's after Paul arrives in Caesarea. You can see, we read the letter over in chapter 23 last week, where in verse 26, Claudius Lysias, the commander in Jerusalem, who had Paul rescued from the Temple Mount. Now, again, I don't want to just keep babbling here, but Luke records that Paul was on the Temple Mount, and someone accused him of bringing Trophimus from Ephesus, the Ephesian Gentile, into the Jewish men's temple courts. A riot breaks out. They shut down the temple. The whole city hears about it. They rush up there. They grab Paul. The Jews grab Paul, according to Luke's account, which I agree with. They start beating Paul, tearing at him, trying to kill him. From the top of Fort Antonia, looking down, Lysias, the commander of the tribune, who's in charge of the 1,000 troops that are under his jurisdiction, which includes 10 centurions, he sends troops down to rescue Paul because he thinks he's a terrorist. He's one of the Sakari, one of the Dagger men. And we talked about that before. These are the Jewish terrorists, the Jewish freedom fighters, the Jewish patriots that are terrorizing, trying to cause a revolt against Rome. This is 57 AD. By 66 AD, they will have succeeded in causing a revolt of the Jewish war. So they're about nine. This is a tinderbox. Within 9 years, historically, this place blows up and the Jewish wars come in. So Luke records that the mob grabs Paul. Lysias goes down. The commander sends his troops down because he thinks Paul is one of the Sakari, one of the Dagger men, and brings him up and finds out that he speaks very good Greek and then asked to speak to the crowd, and Paul addresses the crowd in Aramaic, or that form of Hebrew at the day, and the crowd becomes very silent. They listen to Paul talk until he talks, says something about going to the Gentiles. Then the crowd erupts again. That's when the commander, still doesn't know who Paul is, straps him out and says, we're going to whip him until we find out who he is. And then Paul says, tells the guys, is it proper to whip a Roman citizen? And they kind of back away. And Lysias comes and says, I had to pay a great cost for mine, because it's Claudius Lysias, meaning he probably bought his citizenship while Claudius was the emperor. And Paul says, I was born a citizen. Quickly, the guys that are going to whip Paul back off, and Lysias releases him, kind of afraid that he's now wrapped up or chained, both chained and brought up to Fort Antonia in chains, a Roman citizen, and then chained for strapping, or strapped for whipping, a Roman citizen. And so when he writes this letter that we're looking at, 23, he says to Lysias, tells Felix, the governor that Lysias is under in Judea, he tells him, when I found out Paul was a Roman citizen, I went down and rescued him from the crowd. Now, when you read Luke's account, that's not what you did. You went down because you thought he's one of the Sicarii, a terrorist, that you wanted information from. And so he went down and basically arrested him and took him to interrogate him. But when he writes the letter to Felix, he's the hero of the story. I rescued a Roman citizen, and now I'm sending him to you for protection because there's a plot to assassinate Paul. So it's like Lysias is painting his own picture. What we're going to find out here is when the lawyer, Tertullius, speaks for the high priest and the Sanhedrin in front of Felix, the governor, and they present their case, their story is going to be different because they're going to make the presentation that the temple priest arrested Paul for violation of a temple rite. It was a very orderly deal. He violated it. We arrested him. And then Lysias came down and took him from us. So basically what the lawyer is going to be asking for is Roman permission to have Paul handed back to them because Lysias made a mistake in taking him from them in their orderly arrest of this violation of the temple. And so they're painting their picture. We orderly arrested him, and then the Romans came down and took him, and now he's in Caesarea, and all we want is our prisoner back so we can try him, and if he's guilty, we'll send him back to the Romans for execution. So you've got Luke's story, you've got Lysias' account, and now you're going to have the lawyer telling Felix his account. Do you understand kind of what I'm saying? It's all the same story, but everybody's a hero in their own account. So here we go. Chapter 24, verse 1. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders, that'd be the Sanhedrin, and a lawyer named Tertullius. Now, the very fact, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. And the very fact the high priest and the Sanhedrin have hired a lawyer, and that is exactly what it is. It's a lawyer. It's an attorney who's trained in not just Jewish law. They don't need a Jewish lawyer, although he understands Jewish law. He's trained in that. He's trained in Roman law because that's what they need. And so you can see the seriousness of this. Imagine if you were in trouble, a speeding ticket, a parking ticket, some charge that are brought against you, and at your court case, the high priest shows up and the Sanhedrin and their hired attorney to come against you, you would realize, I'm not getting out of this parking ticket. I've got the big guns coming after me. And so you have here, you couldn't get any bigger players in this game coming against Paul in Judea, appearing before the governor with the tribune from Jerusalem coming later to explain his side of the story. So Paul is surrounded by the biggest players possible in Judea, and it's heavily stacked against him. You understand that? It's interesting because it gives you the picture of how big a deal this is to the Jews. If this was a small fish, if this was a mere mouse in the game of the religious world, they wouldn't go to this effort. But they're traveling, 60 miles, I think it is, through hill country, on horseback most likely, to get to this trial that they've lost. And all they want is to bring Paul back so they can try put him in trial where he was originally in Jerusalem. Let's just read it. Here we go. Okay. When Paul was called in, he's released from prison, he's brought in probably with guards, when Paul was called in, Tertullius, the lawyer, presented his case before Felix. Now, what he begins is a typical, I've got some notes there on the, you can see right here. It was typical to begin with flattery, to kind of win the judge, win the governor over to your side. Meaning, if you come in there with an attitude right away, the judge is making his mind, if I can burn you, I'm going to burn you in this case. But instead, they come in and very, very pleased with Felix. Very, very, well, here's what he says. It says, when Paul was called in, Tertullius presented his case before Felix and says, "We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation, everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix." And again, that's our reference that we begin the book with, or begin Luke with again, most excellent Theophilus. Again, some statement of nobility, connection to the Senate, upper layer of society. Most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. So he mentions here peace, foresight, as far as reforms, taking us into this new century, this new decade of reforms with Roman rule. And yet at the same time, Governor Felix, when you go back and look, he was involved with, and the tribune, as you see, hunting the Sicarii, hunting and killing the patriots. Again, whichever way you want to fall on the side of the Sicarii, the patriots, the freedom fighters, they were the daggermen who were killing people in crowds, trying to cause a revolt, trying to get the public to come against. It was a political, they're basically a political group to try and get public uprising against the Romans. There's two political groups. There's many political groups in Rome, or in the Jews, of course. But we basically got the Jews versus the Romans. The Jews are divided. They've been divided since before Rome came in 63. They got the Pharisees, the Sadducees. They've got all kinds of different pockets of people. And they're at one time, they're killing each other, their own civil war. But the Sicarii are trying to unite them against the bigger enemy, the Romans. This is what they were afraid of Jesus. That's why they feared Jesus, because they are afraid Jesus, the people that wanted to keep peace with Rome, was afraid Jesus was one of these type of Sicarii, although he never, you know, used a sword, but that he was trying to rise up some kind of public support that would lead against Rome. That's why they basically got rid of him, was because if it was for political reasons, it's to keep Jesus and his people calm down so they don't lead to a revolt. By the very doing that, false Christs are going to arise and are going to lead to the revolt of 66 AD and then eventually 135 AD. So anyway, Felix has been keeping peace Roman style of hunting and killing these Sicarii. So yes, he's kept peace, but he's been slaughtering or killing Jews that get out of bounds, stay in our jurisdiction, cooperate with us in our government, cooperate with us in our jurisdiction, but you rise up, we'll hunt you down and exterminate you. And so it's partially true, but basically it's flattery. They talk about insight. They talk about reform. And he's very grateful and gives the impression, we're very grateful for this. And basically they say, now we just want to take Paul back and try him. And then if he's guilty, you guys can execute him. That's the story. Okay, verse 5. We have found this man to be a troublemaker. And again, troublemaker means pestilence. It means he's sweeping across lands causing a disease. And the disease is a theological, it's a philosophical, it's a revolt. And it goes on, stirring up riots or seditions among the Jews all over the world. And in a sense, yes, this is true. Although we would not see it as a pestilence, we would not see it as seditions or revolts. Paul goes into synagogues and brings them the good news that the Messiah has come, salvation by faith in Jesus Christ, as prophesied throughout the Old Testament. He lines up all the scriptures. It works out perfectly. He's not coming in with weapons. He's not coming in with threats. He's just coming in with just the promise. And indeed, there have been throughout all of, you just name the places Paul's gone to, and there's been seditions. There's been revolts. Synagogues have split from Corinth all the way through Asia Minor. So that is he is for the Jews. And this may be why the high priest, and they've got a lawyer, is Paul is now in Jerusalem with Gentiles and Gentile money that has come down to support Jews, trying to make sure the Gentiles and Jews work together. But he's already done that all the way across Asia Minor, over into Greece. He's gone from city to city to city and split synagogues. They're happily getting along. He comes in, some have faith in Christ. That's what Luke has recorded all the way through the book of Luke, is Paul's gone from synagogue to synagogue, bringing the good message, the word. it's not Paul that is dividing them. It's the sword of the word of truth, that he brings them the truth and the people decide. So, again, those charges are true, but it makes it sound like he's a disease. And again, in the Jewish mind who've rejected Christ, Paul is a disease spreading and dividing synagogues, causing sedition and riots all across the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. Now, that's kind of a fun example. That's what they're calling. The Jews are not calling it Christianity. They're calling it the Nazarene sect. And again, sect would be the word heresy. And it's a sect of Judaism. Again, the word heresy at this time could be negative, or it could be, as Josephus uses it, like, you know, when he writes in Rome, heresy or sect is a word that he used. The Pharisees were a sect or a heresy, a group, different from the Sadducees who were a group. And he used the word more in a non-accusative way, not a negative way. But these guys are saying it's a Jewish sect, it's a Jewish heresy that is causing division, and we want it stopped. So that's what they're accusing Paul of, or that's what they're describing. That's not what they're accusing him of. That's what they're describing him as. He is a ringleader, we would say apostle, of the Nazarene sect, we would say of Christianity, and even tried to desecrate the temple. Now here comes the charges. Even tried to desecrate the temple, and this is where the whole thing is going to basically fall apart in Roman law. So we seized him. Okay, there, you see that right there? So we, the lawyer says, so we, and he's representing the Sanhedrin and the high priest, so we seized him. And who's going to do the seizing for the high priest and the Sanhedrin? That would be your temple guards coming from the tribe of Levi. They would be the military that's guarding the gates of the temple, and they're the keepers of the gates. They would have gone in and in an orderly fashion arrested Paul and take him into custody. So that's what he's saying. We seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. Now, again, they did not seize him. The mob captured him, were pulling at him, beating at him, tearing his clothes. He was bloody, beaten, and the Romans rescued him from the mob because they thought, again, that he was one of, like you thought, he was one of the Sicarii, and he wanted to get more information. And then he's going to backtrack that. He's not going to admit that. But, of course, this is, again, their side of the story. It was an orderly arrest. He is our prisoner. We've arrested him. It wasn't a mob. It was the Levites. Now they turn it this way, verse 8, by examining him yourself, you'll be able to learn the truth about these charges we are bringing against him. The Jews joined in the accusation, and that would probably be, that's not a mob, that would be probably the Sanhedrin leaders that came in, asserting that these things were true. Now, if you don't mind, there's one group missing here. There's a group missing here. They say, if you ask him questions, you will find out these things are true. Then the members of the Sanhedrin, they say Jews. I'm assuming it's members of the Sanhedrin that made the trip with the high priest and the lawyer. They're high-ranking people. They join in and says, this is what happened. This is what happened. And they're sharing their side of the story. They're the accusers. But what is actually missing here is the Ephesians. And this is probably going to Ephesian Jews, I'll just say. They're the ones that came down and they recognized in the streets, and Paul had come to Jerusalem with a delegation of Gentiles from Corinth, from Macedonia, from Ephesus, maybe from Galatia, but we got the names of them. They all came down and they brought Gentile money to support the poor Jews. We know this because it's recorded in Romans, it's recorded in 1 Corinthians. When Paul leaves Jerusalem after the first Jerusalem council, they asked him to remember the poor. And that was, he writes that in Galatians, to remember the poor, that was remember the poor that are suffering in Jerusalem. So when Paul goes out, they says, go to the Gentiles, but remember the poor here in Jerusalem that we are suffering because the Jews are oppressing us. And so when he was sharing the gospel, he was sharing the Jewish blessing, and he says this very clearly, he's sharing the Jewish blessing with the Gentiles by faith in the Jewish Messiah, Christ, Jesus. But he says other places, likewise, we should share our prosperity with those who are suffering for the cause of Christ in Jerusalem. Basically, you get the spiritual blessing and bless them with some kind of financial blessing to keep them strong because they're suffering for the gospel that you're reaping the benefits of. And you can see that in Paul's writings a couple places. So Paul brings this Gentile money down. So when Paul goes to the temple, that time that he gets arrested. There are Jews that know Paul has gone to the Gentiles. They know he split synagogues. They know he's friendly with Gentiles. And it's pretty soon going to come out the church has received Gentile financial support for their cause, which is supporting a Messiah that the Jewish people, the Sanhedrin, the high priest, as a whole, as a group, has rejected. And so Paul is in this. So when he goes on the Temple Mount, they assume, because he's such a liberal Jew, he doesn't follow the law, and they've exaggerated his teaching, like people always do in accusations politically or religiously, that he doesn't even want to recognize the temple. He wants the temple torn down and all this. And so for Paul, they figure Paul would just very willingly bring a Gentile into the temple courts with the Jewish men. He doesn't do that, but they assume when they see Paul, I'm sure he brought the Gentiles in, and they start the riot. Now, these are the Ephesian men who recognize Trophimus in the streets with Paul, but they don't actually see Trophimus on the Temple Mount with Paul in the Jewish quarter. Now, Paul's in the Jewish men's quarter because he's a Jew. He can go there. And when they see Paul there, they start saying things that aren't true, which stirs up a revolt. Again, you can see this happening today in politics on all across. It's like, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. It's like, not so. Well, look, we got this report. I mean, they're just causing a frenzy. Once you get the frenzy started, once you get the mob moving, you've lost control. Law and order is out the window. So now Rome was great at. You may like Rome, you may accuse Rome, whatever, but Rome was big on law. They had a system that held them for years, and I think we are still part of that system. I've talked about that last week and Monday night. I don't want to go there. But this is the legal system. You have laws of the land. So now it's back in the Roman courts, and so now they're making these accusations. But what the Roman court needs now is not Ananias, not the Sanhedrin, and all what they're heard and what they're accusing, or even a lawyer making a presentation. What they need is the witnesses. These are the people the Ephesian Jews saw it and says, there he is, he's got a Gentile court, and it all goes into an uproar. Okay, well, we're back to this. So let's hear the witnesses. Now, they aren't there. They're not there. Now, maybe they had to go back to Ephesus. Maybe their story wasn't going to stand up in a Roman court. We don't know. But all we know is these guys are loaded for bear. They've got the high priest. They've got a trained lawyer, a professional lawyer. They've got the Sanhedrin coming against Paul for walking across a line, going behind the barrier into the Jewish courts with a Gentile man. And, okay, who saw this? Well, we just know it's true. These guys saw it. Where are they at? Now, we're not there yet, but where are they at? And in Roman law, if these guys don't show up, they may have made the accusation, went back to Ephesus. But if they're not going to be here to follow up with the accusation and go on, they've got to go under questioning. You're going to make an accusation. We saw this. Okay, we're going to ask you, we're going to ask Paul some questions. But who are they telling Felix to ask questions of? They say, you can ask Paul, and you'll find out what he did. Hoping Paul does this. Shoots his mouth off. Says more than he's supposed to. But you got to, he's going to be a hothead. We're just going to get him talking. Get him on Twitter. Let him just put some tweets out there. And just watch him. Just get him riled up. He'll accuse himself. They wanted Jesus to do the same thing. They say, tell us. And Jesus played the card very well. He says, you could ask. He said, I spoke publicly. You got any accusers? He says, where are my accusers? Jesus, I don't want to say he was mouthy, but Jesus, anyway, he was cooperative, if you want to call it cooperative. He's chained, he's brought in, drug in. And then when he says that, where are my accusers? He says, I'm not going to testify. You ask me to testify against myself? No. You're the one bringing charges. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to make your job easy. And then they slapped him. And he says, whoa, you're slapping me? And you don't even have any accusers. What is your... So Jesus was playing the legal game when he was arrested. And now these guys, and you see it again, it sounds legitimate till you look at it. Chapter 24, verse 6, and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him, decently, like our law says, by examining him, talking to Felix, yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about these charges we are bringing against him. You just, here's Paul, just ask him some questions. Well, where's my accusers? You guys are saying you've got witnesses. Where are they? The Jews joined in the accusations, kind of got some steam going, asserting that these things were true. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replies. Now, here's lawyer Paul. Now, realize, several things are happening here. Is one, he's not out of his league. He's addressed synagogues. He was trained for this. He knows Jewish law. He knows Roman law. He spoke in Athens to philosophers. He loves public speaking. He calmed the very group of people, the riot that broke out that was beating and tearing his clothes, trying to kill him. When he has a chance to speak, he speaks in Aramaic and talks to them for maybe 15, 20 minutes, and then finally says something about the Gentiles, and then they go off. So, I mean, he's able to speak to the mobs. In Ephesus, when there was a riot, what did he want to do? He wanted to go down to the theater and speak to the Gentiles in there trying to grade his Artemis of the Ephesians. They said, no, Paul, you're going to get killed by the mob. And they would not let him go. So Paul's now like, oh, my gosh, well, what am I going to do? I'm on trial here. Paul's like, oh, man, it's like letting a lion loose with some raw meat. He's ready for this. So Paul replied. Now, he's going to start the same way, although he's not going to lie or fib or exaggerate. He says, I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. In other words, he said, for a number of years, which means that's the truth, you've been here for many years, you're still here, you are the judge, you are the ruler, I give you my respect, and now here's what I say. So in the end, he doesn't lie to him that we've enjoyed peace. He just says, I recognize your position, you are the judge of the land, and here's my word. So again, he honors him, recognizes his authority. He doesn't say, you know, you're not my governor, not my governor, not my governor. It's like, you are my governor. You've been here for years. I respect your authority. Now, here's my defense, you know. He says, you can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. And so he says, I can recount it for you, and I've got it written out there for you, and you can go through, you can see it right there. Luke records it, and that's kind of important because that's part of his defense. 12 days. These are the days I was there. So everything you're looking for has to happen in the last 2 weeks. That's everything is right there. And there's witnesses all around. I mean, these people aren't dead. They're not in another country. They're right here in Judea. It was 12 days ago in Jerusalem. So I gladly make my defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Okay? He's going there to worship. And he is planning on going to the Temple Mount. The entire time he's planning on going to the Temple Mount because he wants to be there in time for the feast. My accusers, there it is. He goes right after it. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. He says, I did not come in and go to the synagogue and start dividing it. I didn't go up in the temple courts and start preaching. Now, you've seen that before. Jesus did that. Other people did that. He went up there to worship. He went up by himself to worship. And he's going to help these men pay for their offerings. He's up there worshiping. So he says, the accusers, these guys are particularly these Ephesian Jews that started the accusations. He says, you can see, I was there. I was worshiping. I was not in a synagogue. There's no record of me being in a synagogue for 12 days. You're not going to hear me preaching in any kind of a church or saying, we need to revolt against the Jews. He says, there's no record of me starting a little sermonette or a speech or gathering a group of people around me on the temple courts. I went up to worship. And basically what he's going to say is, they saw me there and they started making accusations. I was doing nothing but going through the procedures every Jew does. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. And the charges are, he brought a Gentile into the Jewish court. He says, they cannot prove it. Why can't they prove it? Because the only way to prove it is to have some kind of eyewitness. Of course, today we could have videotape, you could have a camera, you could have some. But they're relying on the eyewitnesses. He heard the Ephesian Jews said this. The lawyer heard from the Sanhedrin and Ananias that the Ephesian Jews saw him. The mob that started the riot heard from the Ephesian Jews. And so what's missing from this whole story, Paul goes right after right away, is where are they? Felix, where are they? There's no one here that can say, defend these charges. They can get excited, they can say all these things, but now let's bring in the witnesses. They don't have any witnesses. So your whole case is based on these eyewitnesses that saw me on the temple court. Now, I'm ad-libbing here. This is not what Paul's saying. I'm just ad-libbing, obviously. But it's like, where are they? Well, he did this. Okay. I'm not going to say I did it. You're saying I did it. Where's your witnesses? And so this thing right here, in Governor Felix, the Roman governor, under Roman law, these witnesses are not here. This case is doing this right here. It's sinking. These guys have nothing. They're loaded. They've got the big players. They've got a lot of money invested. But what are they missing? They're missing their eyewitnesses. So from the get-go, obviously you can see this. Okay, in verse 13, and they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I admit, now again, that's his legal position. There's his legal presentation. However, I'm not done. I do want to slip in here my views. Again, because God told him on the road to Damascus, and several times, it's been confirmed, you will appear before kings and leaders of the Gentiles, and you must testify about me. Jesus just appeared to him in Jerusalem, we saw last chapter, that just like you testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must testify for me in Rome. Don't worry, you're going to do the same thing in Rome, because from the very beginning, Paul was the stand in front of leaders. And when you go through the book of Acts, you go through Paul's ministry, it's amazing how many leaders, government officials, that he had no business being in charge of. He just walks in somewhere to a city, and pretty soon he's in front of the leadership. He walks in somewhere, and he ends up in Nero's court on two different occasions, where he's testifying to Nero, not just Nero privately, but whoever's there, the lawyers, the Praetorian Guard, and he's sharing the gospel. We're going to see as the rest of the book of Acts, Felix, Paul's going to be in custody there in Caesarea for two more years. And during Felix's time there, he's going to call at different times, and Festus, the same way, will call and talk to Paul. And Paul's already made his defense, so he's not going to be going back. He's going to be just telling him what he believes. He's going to be sharing the gospel with the Roman governors. Here it is. He says, however, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. Again, that is the word heresy in the Greek, which isn't necessarily heresy. Like if you hear someone's teaching heresy, it's time to back away. But if you hear someone's teaching pre-trib, mid-trib, post-trib, it's like those are different views of a topic. I agree with some of them, I disagree with others, but you can't really say it's a heresy in the negative sense. It's a group, it's a sect, it's a way of viewing and interpreting Scripture. You've almost got to approach it and consider it. Anyway, this is not a negative word, but notice what he says. I admit that I worship the God of our fathers. I admit that I am in line with these guys. I am a Jew. I worship the same God they worship. But I worship him with the understanding that Jesus is the fulfillment and the way to fulfill this, which, of course, is growing in popularity. And Felix himself is not unfamiliar with it. The way, the sect, the Nazarene. So just by saying Nazarene, they're one of the Nazarenes, it's like they've already got a title in there. So Paul says, I admit, I follow these guys, but I feel, I believe, I understand that Jesus is the way for the total fulfillment of this. So now he's preaching. Now he's now making people make a decision. Now he's not dividing a synagogue, he's dividing the council, he's dividing the court, he's dividing the Sanhedrin. And remember, some of these Sanhedrin, depending on who they brought along, some of them are Pharisees, some of them are Sadducees. I would bet if the high priest had anything to do with it, and he's lawyering up with Tertullius, he's not bringing any Pharisees along because he learned his lesson in the last Sanhedrin here. Remember when Paul says, I am a Pharisee, I believe in the resurrection? They probably leave the Pharisee, you know, it's like leaving the Democrats or the Republicans behind and bringing your own party along. I think they're lawyered up with Tertullius and some Sanhedrin members that are Sadducees. Again, that's my guess, but I don't. That's just those, you know, me thinking, but may not be true. Verse 14, however, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. And that would mean they call it a branch of Judaism. They're not calling it, he's not saying it's a heresy they've rejected. They're saying it's a form of Judaism that understands things differently than we do. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. So the law, the Sadducees would agree with that. And that is written in the prophets, the Sadducees would be like, no, they don't believe the prophets. We talked about that before. So he's a Pharisee because he said, I believe the law and the prophets. The Sadducees would just believe the law. That's the first five books. And I have the same hope in God as these men that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Now that's what got him to divide the Sanhedrin. So if there are Pharisees here with him in this group, they're like saying, okay, he believes the full Old Testament, we call it, and he believes in the resurrection. He's leaving the Sanhedrin behind because he's not going to lie. But he says, I believe the same thing they believe as far as the Torah, but I also accept the prophets, which is, you know, they may not agree with it, but they function with the Pharisees. So that's part of their system. And with the resurrection of the dead, which was growing in popularity through all these years from Daniel, is continuing to grow because they believe in the resurrection of the dead. Sadducees did not, although they should have. There's enough evidence in the Torah. But anyway, and I have the same hope in God as these men that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. Because I believe that I'm going to stand before God, I'm not trying to do something wrong here. So now he's talking about his own character. He's talking about his character. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem. So the last time he was in Jerusalem was probably about 5 years before, when he finished his second missionary trip, sailed into Jerusalem, and then went back up to Antioch. And then from there, he went straight into Ephesus. That's the third missionary trip. So it was about 5 years before. Before that would have been 49 AD, when he was down for the Jerusalem Council. So, you know, 49 AD, 59. So you can see kind of how we're in 57 AD. You can see the different, you know, 5, 9 years before. So absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. So that's why he came. We know he brought gifts to the poor. That's from the money for the Christian believers, the Jewish believers. So he brought gifts for the poor. So he came to Jerusalem. He's saying, I came to Jerusalem for two things. Felix, I'm in Jerusalem for two things. One, money for the poor. And two, as any Jew, I'm here to worship. That was my purpose for being here. Money for the poor. It's like, and where's the criminal? This guy. He said, I'm trying to live a good life. I'm aware of the resurrection of the dead, so I'm conscious of the fact that I'll stand before God. Why did I come to Jerusalem? Not for a revolt, not for anything except to bring money to the poor and to worship on the Temple Mount. Now, that should shake some people. Again, I've said this before, but Paul was not afraid as a believer in Jesus Christ, as the writer of the New Testament, to go up on the Temple Mount and worship in a Jewish fashion at the temple and feel like it was some kind of violation. Now, he wasn't real big on saying, we got to get all the Gentiles to do the same thing. He was clear on saying, it's faith in Jesus Christ, but he was a Pharisee, he was a Jew, this was his culture. He is not afraid of worshiping as a Jew, as a Jewish believer in Jesus Christ on the Temple Mount. Now, there are some people that can't handle that thinking. Again, I might be wrong, but right here he's saying, I'm in Jerusalem to worship. And when he says Jerusalem to worship, he's not saying worship at the local church. He's meaning worship on Jewish Temple Mount, as you can see he's doing. Verse 17, after an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. When they found me, I was in the process of worshiping, and I was worshiping properly because I'd come out of Gentile lands, so I was unclean according to the law. But I'd taken a seven-day period of cleansing, washing on the third day and on the seventh day, and then approaching the Temple Mount to worship. So he was he wasn't unclean. He'd spent, of the seven of the 12 days he was there, seven of those days were preparing himself to actually approach. Now, when I go to Jerusalem, I don't know when I'm going to go again. It makes it sound like I go every weekend. I've gone to Jerusalem three times. But when we go, we just go up and walk in. We don't do any ritual. We just show up. The biggest deal is flying there and getting there and not getting lost. And then I just walk up there. But Paul arrived in Jerusalem, and then before he went to the temple, in fact, the first time we went to Jerusalem in 2007, we arrived at like 10:30 at night, and of course that's like, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning here or something, so we're like wide awake. First thing we did, it was dark, it was really cool, lights and streetlights. We went right down to the Western Wall and looked at it right there. So first thing I did when I got to Jerusalem was go look at the Temple Mount. I didn't go up on it at that time. But I want you to my point, my whole point for saying that, is when Paul arrives, he is a Jew there to worship on the Temple Mount, but before he can go there, he has to spend 7 days going through ritual cleansing so he can approach the Temple Mount. Me, a Gentile, I just show up and walk up there. So, again, my point is he is being very obedient, very respectful of the Temple Mount going through this period of cleansing. That's what he's pointing out. He's following the law. Even his approach to the temple was according to the law. So he's not a lawbreaker. He doesn't want to burn the temple down. He's there to worship at the temple, and in his process of worshiping, he's very diligent to follow protocol. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews, here he says, here they are. There are some Jews, if you want to go find them, from the province of Asia, Ephesus, who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Where are they at? He says, I'm telling you, here's my eyewitness. I was there for 12 days. I spent 7 days of cleansing. I came to worship. I also brought money for the poor to give away. There was no crowd. There's no disturbance. You can see I wasn't in a synagogue. I wasn't in the temple courts preaching. I came to worship. I went through the ceremony cleansing. I went up. I was alone. There wasn't a crowd around me. I was in the process of worshiping. And then these guys, who I've erased, the Ephesians, or the men from Asia, started making accusations. So there's my eyewitness account. That's my testimony. Now, where's their testimony? I gave you my eyewitness account. I've got 12 days. I've got witnesses the whole 12 days. It's not going to be hard for Paul in the next 2 years to put together a day-by-day, hour-by-hour account with witness after witness of his behavior on the temple courts. Okay, it's your turn. And they've got nothing. My accusers did not find me arguing, I'm in verse 12, with anyone in the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else, and they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I admit that I am a worshiper. I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect, which means almost they're accepting it as one of the possible ways of interpreting it. Remember, many of the priests believed, many Pharisees have become believers. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance, but there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or these who are here should state the crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. He's already been on trial before the Sanhedrin, and they had a split decision. So that's going to be at his advantage. Half the Sanhedrin already has been on record as saying what? We find nothing wrong with this man. He said, where's that testimony? Where's the testimony of the Sanhedrin that they find nothing wrong with me? Unless it was one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence, he says when I shouted, it is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. He says, I did say this. And all of a sudden that just pushes the front, that decision that was made that day. Some shouted, and that really never came to an end because the Romans had to come in and rescue him from the Sanhedrin because half of them says, we agree with him. Half says, he needs to die. Then Felix, again, this is the governor, who's heard now the high priest's testimony from his lawyer, the Tertullius, and then some of the other Sanhedrins. He's heard Paul make a brilliant defense. It's not just stammering. You can break it down and just, you know, the points he's making. And then he leaves it with Felix. Now the governor. Then Felix, who was, look at this, was well acquainted with the way. It's like he's well, what does he mean, well acquainted? It's he's heard of it? Or it's like, yeah, I've been approached with this several times. I've got family, no, I'm making this up. I've got family members that are, I've had discussions publicly, privately, I know people. He's acquainted with the way. He knows about Jesus. Now, is he a believer or not? That's not the point here. But he's familiar. Adjourning the proceedings. When Felix was well acquainted with the way, he adjourned the proceedings and said, when Lysias, the commander, comes, he says, I'll decide your case. In other words, I'm going to wait now for Lysias, who is the one who observed this whole thing take place. When he comes, I'll have him explain it to me. and then I'll decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard. Again, I might make this point so we don't lose it. Not in prison, chained to a wall, being beaten, but under guard. He is a Roman citizen who's had charges brought to him by the Jews who've on several occasions tried to kill him on the Temple Mount, tried to kill him in the Sanhedrin, had a plot of assassination against him, and now the Romans have basically rescued one of their citizens, and he's under guard, he's under protective custody. And that's going to explain that's what it's going to be for this whole 5 years. So please get in your mind, Paul is in prison, the prison epistles, but he's not writing them, you know, chained to a wall, writing on a piece of, you know, papyrus with some kind of a pen or blood coming out of it. He's probably at a desk. We know he's at a rented apartment. People are coming and going in Rome. Well, here he is now in custody in Caesarea. Again, yes, he is in prison, but he's under Roman protection in prison. He's got a better chance of staying alive here than out in the public. He ordered, verse 23, he ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. So what kind of freedom? Does he get to walk around the palace courts? I mean, does he get to have... what kind of a freedom? But it's like, he's not a prisoner, guys. He's under your protection. Several days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla. Now, this is, again, the governor. He's now going to come with his wife, Drusilla. Drusilla is the daughter of Herod Agrippa I. So Herod Agrippa I has a son named Herod Agrippa II, who's coming in the story. He's got a daughter named Bernice who's coming in the story. And now this is Drusilla, one of his daughters, who's Herod Agrippa would be related to Herod the Great. And he can trace back into the Hasmoneans through Miriam. And, you know, we could do the whole genealogy. And in the framework book, there's a Herod time chart or a family tree. But this, again, is as Drusilla is as close to, she's not from the tribe of David. She'd be from the priestly tribe, but she's as close to royalty that the Jews have at that time. Not Davidic royalty, but from the Hasmoneans, from the Maccabees. And anyway, so Felix the governor is married to Drusilla, who is a Jew, whose husband is a follower of a law, who herself is a Jew. Okay, it says several days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla, who was a Jew. Her father, Herod Agrippa, followed the law. She is described as a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. Now, is that, there it is. After all this, Drusilla says, oh, yeah, whatever. I don't know the conversation, but for some reason, Felix says, he brings his wife in. They sit down and say, bring Paul. Paul, tell us more. And if Paul, where do I begin? It's like Paul already knows where to begin. He goes through and they listen to him. How long? We're going to see some of his conversation or his presentations here in a couple of weeks. But he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. Can you imagine the Apostle Paul speaking to the Roman governor Felix and his Jewish wife Drusilla, who's a descendant of the Maccabees, there in Herod the Great's palace in the Mediterranean Sea at Caesarea? As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. Now, he's not just going off on theology, eschatology, and all, soteriology, who is Christ. He then gets into righteousness, self-control, which would be a fruit of the Spirit. We see that in Galatians. And the judgment to come. So he starts something. The standard of righteousness is basically theology and God's expectation for humanity. Then would be self-control would be your manifestation of that character in your life and probably other things. Probably maybe make some points about lack of self-control. And then the judgment to come, there's your eschatology. So from theology to the fruit of the Spirit of your own life to the end of judgment, that's what he's saying. He says, the judgment to come. Felix was afraid and says, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. In other words, Felix the governor, hearing Paul talk, he's not afraid of the Jews. He's not afraid of this. But when Paul starts talking about the existence of God and his standard of righteousness and his ability to transform our lives in Christ Jesus by faith so that we might manifest the fruit of the Spirit's self-control. And if we fail to understand him as Lord, if we fail to manifest the character he desires in life, that there will be hell to pay, judgment, excuse me, there'll be judgment in the end. It's like, Felix is like, okay, it says, Luke says right here, Felix was afraid. So Luke, apparently, again, Luke is with Paul. It's very, very good chance Luke is sitting there. He might be one of the friends that's coming and going. Luke might be staying at Philip's house. We don't know. I mean, he's coming and going, and Paul's under custody. Luke's coming and going. But he may be sitting there listening to this, watching Felix, eyes bulge, look at Drusilla, and Drusilla's like, that's exactly, yes, I've heard this preached before. Exactly. That's exactly what the prophets say. And Felix is like, oh my gosh, that's enough. That's enough for now. At a more convenient time, I will send for you. Holy smokes. And you know, I'm ad-libbing again, but I'm just reading what it says. Felix was afraid, Luke says. That's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. In other words, he's hoping, well, it says it right there. Okay, Paul, come and talk to me again. And Paul's always going to go right back to that topic and thinks, okay, that's enough. Basically, I'm just giving you a chance because you've got friends. You've got Luke coming and going. You've got people over to Philip's house. Philip's got his own house. They've got kids in private school. I mean, you've got money here in Caesarea, Paul. Why don't you get some and bring it to me and I'll just dismiss you, put you on a boat and send you where you want to go and you're gone. So, Paul, what do you have to say today? Well, I'd like to pick up where I left off. And go right back to the gospel. It's like, Paul, bribe. I mean, do I need to use flashcards? Bribe me. And Paul says, I'll be right. Well, when you ever need me, I'll finish the story next time. What's wrong with this guy? It's like he's content to be in prison and just preach to me. You can give me money and I'll let you go. No, I'm convenient. This is right where God wants me. Preaching to you whenever you send for me. It's like, so there it is. Again, I'm ad-libbing here. You can read it yourself and make your own conclusions. When I find it convenient, I'll send it for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and that's the next governor, but because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So Felix, of course, his wife is a Jew. He's got these guys he wants to keep. Once you get the Sanhedrin upset, you get the high priest upset. They're going to side with the Sicarii, who Felix is hunting and trying to stop. So these guys are at least on his side. He's got their prison for a summary. And Felix probably doesn't. He's willing to let Paul go for money. So he's got. There's nothing here, Paul, except these guys want you here. So if I let you go, I need some money because I've got to somehow compensate these guys, the high priest, the Sanhedrin. But as long as you're nothing, I'm making them happy by keeping you here. It's to my advantage not to let you go. So it's just, I want to keep these guys happy. Plus, his wife's a Jewess. Maybe she sides with these guys. She might be a Sadducee because she's from the priest line, potentially. Again, I can't say for sure. But it says in chapter 25, 3 days after arriving at the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented their charges against Paul. They urgently requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. So after 2 years of being in prison, Festus takes over, replaces Felix. He goes up from his Herod's palace there in the Mediterranean Sea in Caesarea, goes up to Jerusalem, and when the Sanhedrin meets him, hi, thanks for coming. Hope we can do for you. There is something you can do for us. We want Paul brought here to stand trial. The first thing on their agenda, or one of the first things, is Paul. We want him back in Jerusalem for trial. Of course, they're going to be planning on assassinating him. It's not about trial at all. That's the first thing they bring up to Festus. So Festus now is going to go back and go, Paul, what is this? Who are you? And so then we got the whole account we're going to go through with Festus. And he's going to be meeting Paul there. So Paul's like a built-in missionary there in Caesarea in Herod's palace. And whenever they call for him, he can just preach the gospel like, you know, a private priesthood right there in the palace. So that's where we're going to go with that. I'll pray, and then you're free to go. I appreciate your time. Keep thinking, keep reading. There's 1,000 things to be said about this and insight and much more. But we'll quit with that. Father, I do thank you so much for the chance to look into your word. We thank you for the testimony Paul gives us, his commitment, his faithfulness to the word, and your faithfulness to him and putting him in the right place. We also ask that we might have the same confidence that we are the right place doing the right thing, that we might be confident, talk about righteousness and self-control and being able to stand before you in the day of judgment. We ask that you would again strengthen our hearts by the Spirit, by your word, and through fellowship with other believers, that we again may accomplish the things you put us here to do. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.